Hello, I'm Julian Warica. Thank you for downloading the BBC World Tonight podcast for Wednesday the 30th of October. A budget of change, that's how the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, billed her speech in the Commons. And with higher taxes and higher levels of spending, we got that change. But will it produce growth? Can business swallow it? And what impact will it have on the political debate in the weeks and months ahead? Also, we're in the key swing state of Wisconsin, less than a week before Americans choose their new president. And we've a word from George Foreman, exactly 50 years after the iconic fight known as the Rumble in the Jungle. It's been an historic day at Westminster.
It is the first budget in our country's history to be delivered by a woman. I am deeply proud to be Britain's first ever female Chancellor of the Exchequer. Yeah.
Rachel Reeves embarking upon her budget speech in the Commons today, the first by a Labour Chancellor in 14 years, in a marathon 76-minute statement which outlined a marked change in priorities from her Conservative predecessors. She laid out big spending decisions and big tax rises. On several occasions, she referred to the hard choices she'd had to make due, she said, to the state of the country's finances left by the previous government.
Their austerity broke our National Health Service. Yes. Their Brexit deal harmed British businesses. Yes. And their mini-budget left families paying the price with higher mortgages. The British people have inherited their failure.
And the Chancellor went on to put a price tag on all of that.
Together, the hole in our public finances this year, which recurs every year, the compensation schemes that they did not fund, and their failure to assess the scale of the challenges facing our public services, means that this budget raises taxes by £40 billion. Any Chancellor standing here today would have to face this reality.
Well, some of that £40 billion will come from rises to capital gains tax and inheritance tax, but the main tax rise affects business.
In today's budget, I am announcing an increase in employers' national insurance contributions. We will increase the rates of employers' national insurance by 1.2 percentage points to 15% from April 2025. And we will reduce the secondary threshold, the level at which employers start paying national insurance on each employee's salary, from £9,100 a year to £5,000. This will raise £25 billion per year by the end of the forecast period. I know that this is a difficult choice. I do not take this decision lightly.
On spending, the Chancellor announced big rises in the health and education budgets in England by 4.7% in real terms this year. There was also more money for defence, for affordable housing for local government, and devolution payments for Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland will also go up. Rishi Sunak, in what was likely to be his last appearance as leader of the opposition in the House of Commons, looked angry from the moment he started speaking, and he didn't hold back.
Time and again, we Conservatives warned Labour would tax, borrow and spend far beyond what they were telling the country. And time and again, they denied they had such plans. But today, the truth has come out. Proof that they planned to do this all along.
And this is how he summed up the budget.
A spree of tax rises they promised the working people of this country they would not do. Yeah. National insurance up. Yeah. Capital gains tax up. Inheritance tax up. Energy taxes up. Business rates up. First time buyer stamp duty up. Pensions tax up. They have fiddled the figures.
In a moment, we'll hear from Labour on that national insurance rise. But first, our political editor, Chris Mason. Chris, we were promised change by Labour back in July. Is today the day we've seen that change, do you think?
I think it is, Julian. Evening to you. Evening. And I think it is on a scale that is greater than was suggested in that election manifesto. And that's probably at the more generous end of the interpretation. Labour were quite cautious in their prospectus going into the election. Labour are traditionally nervous of losing elections because they lose far more than they win, and they tend to hug the Conservatives close going into general elections they think they can win. And they broadly did that. I remember Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeve saying over and over again when I asked them during the campaign about tax that they had no plans to raise tax beyond those specific ones that they had pointed to. And yet here we see this absolute welter of taxes. Now, if you ever doubt there being a significant difference between the two main parties at Westminster, take a look at this budget, because this has Labour's values, instincts, worldview, if you like, stamped all the way through it. And it's for a listener to conclude if that's something to their taste or not.
And the tone between the two main players today. I mean, that illustrated that as well, didn't it?
Well, it did. And one of the quirks of Rishi Sunak still being in post, he would much rather have not been in post for this long, is that it was personal, this, for him. He fought that campaign. He lost it by a country mile. The critique was of his economic record, both as Prime Minister and as Chancellor. He'll stand down in a couple of days with a new Conservative leader elected at the weekend. And you could hear the authenticity of his anger. And yes, the Conservative message during the election was that Labour would put up taxes. The critique, of course, made of the Conservatives is that they had managed the public finances towards the end in a way that was going to be unsustainable whoever won, and have made tax cuts, so the argument goes, that weren't affordable.
More spending for some departments, as I outlined. Not all, though. What of those winners and losers and reaction to that?
Yeah, so speaking to Labour folk, broadly speaking, they're happy because they see a document that's just, as I say, something they'd have loved to see in every budget of the last 15 years, and this is the first chance they've had to do it. What I'm struck by is that despite this colossal increase in tax, the actual increases in spending in lots of places are relatively modest. Now, that's partially because of the amount that is being paid to service the national debt, the interest payments associated with that. And then one big picture point, Julian, the forecasts around growth in the coming years, the government's central mission, are pretty anemic. And then the projections for disposable household income per person are pretty poor too. So if the government doesn't manage to create the conditions where either or both of those things improve, you can anticipate a pretty cheesed off electorate come the next general election, almost irrespective of what Labour managed to or not to do.
Chris, thank you very much for that. Well, throughout the day, we've been speaking to business people for their reaction to the budget, with a particular focus on the rise in national insurance contributions for employers, as well as the rise in employers' allowance that the Chancellor also announced, which will exempt the smallest employers from those payments. Hannah, you will hear first, owns a boutique fitness studio in South London. Robert is an independent cafe owner from Hampshire. And Leanne runs a small accounting business in Norfolk. Here's what they had to say.
It is quite a rise for employers' national insurance. However, the allowance changes for small businesses is a really big relief to see that alongside it. For me as a small business, that would allow me to employ 4 members of staff full time without needing to pay any national insurance contributions. Obviously, we have increased minimum wage, the national living wage, to look at for next year. So, of course, we're happy to ensure that our staff are earning more money, but we do also need to look at where that money is coming from. So there will have to be a passed on cost to our customers and a rise in the price of our services.
In terms of the national insurance rise, I think that's a bit of a give and take, isn't it? So 13.8% going up to 15% is negative, but at the same time, the employment allowance has been raised from £5,000 to £10,500. So for a small business such as ourselves, I'm hopeful that the effect of that is net zero. I think the part of the budget that's concerning to me and will be to many is the change on business rates. So where we've been lucky enough to receive a 75% rates relief, that will drop to a 40% relief, which is the equivalent of a doubling of our rates next year.
I'm quite a small business, but I'd say I'm not one of the really, really tiny ones that's going to benefit from the raise in employment allowance. For me personally, we are definitely going to be significantly worse off. We have 8 employees, so we are a little bit in the middle. We're not big enough to swallow this big rate increase on national insurance, but we're not small enough to make the benefit of the employment allowance being raised up to $10,500.
Independent accountant Leanne before her, Robert, who runs a cafe, and Hannah, who owns her own fitness studio. Well, earlier I spoke to Emma Reynolds, the Parliamentary Secretary at the Treasury. We discussed that national insurance rise, but I began by asking her about growth, a central aim of the Chancellor. Was she concerned that the Office for Budget Responsibility was now predicting lower growth over the next 5 years than it did before the budget?
We had some very big calls to make at this budget because we inherited a parlous state of the finances with a £22 billion black hole. We promised to restore economic stability and invest in our public services and in particular to fix the NHS. The economy is set to grow throughout the period, but we've got to take some long-term decisions during that time. And this obviously won't be the last budget that we do, but we're confident that given the success of the recent International Investment Summit and setting forward our plans for the National Wealth Fund and the Modern Industrial Strategy, that, you know, you can't do all of this in one budget or one fiscal event, but we have some big proposals going forward, and you'll hear more about those in the spring as well.
The economy is set to grow, as you say, but the OBR has downgraded its growth forecasts for 2026 to 29 based on what's been announced today.
Well, if you look at the forecast from March, the OBR has been very clear that their forecast from the previous government would have been materially different had they known some of the pressures that the previous government were frankly hiding. We only discovered the black hole in the public finances the day after the election. You are comparing our forecast today on our budget with, frankly, what was a forecast based on lies from the previous government.
But can it be a budget for growth if we see an increase in national insurance contributions for employers, the hike in the minimum wage, which was announced yesterday? We've already had the Employment Rights Bill announced in previous weeks. Can that put together bring about growth? Because a lot of businesses are saying it might cost them quite a lot of money.
Actually, a million businesses across the country will not be adversely affected by the change in national insurance. We've more than doubled the employment allowance, which means that a business, a small business employing 4 full-time employees on the living wage would be taken out of paying national insurance contribution altogether. So it is a more of a mixed picture than some of the coverage has suggested.
Do you acknowledge that the OBR is right to say that 3/4 of the impact of employer NICs will be felt by employees, even if the changes don't show up on payslips?
Well, that remains to be seen. Businesses will have to take decisions about what they do about the increase in employer national insurance. But some will perhaps pass that down, increase in prices. Some will take different decisions.
Can we talk about where you're spending the money as well? Obviously, a lot of emphasis on health and on education and some huge sums of money involved there. But there are other departments that are not going to fare nearly as well, aren't there? The Home Office will see a real terms cut of over 3% both this year and next year. The Department of Transport will rise by 1.2% this year and then fall by 2.5% the following year. So it's an end of austerity for some, but not all, isn't it?
Well, we have to get on top of the backlog of a spending that was being spent on hotels for asylum seekers. And in the round, departmental day-to-day budgets will grow at 1.5% in real terms of 24-25.
Paul Johnson of the Institute for Fiscal Studies has talked about the element of gamble in this budget from the Chancellor and looks ahead to a couple of years from now and says she may well need to come back with another round of tax rises in a couple of years' time unless she gets lucky on growth. Do you acknowledge that there is a gamble to all of this?
I have great respect for the IFS, but I do not agree with his analysis. We are creating the right conditions for growth. We're doing a lot on the supply side. We've lifted the ban on offshore wind. We are going to reform the planning system. We've created the National Wealth Fund. We're ensuring that there is an investment pipeline for UK pensions. So there's a lot of other measures that we're taking forward on growth that go beyond and indeed precede the budget. But I don't agree with his analysis that it is somehow a gamble. No, I don't.
Emma Reynolds, the Parliamentary Secretary at the Treasury. Well, our economics editor, Faisal Islam, is here with me. Rachel Reeves said earlier to Chris Mason, Faisal, this is not a budget we want to repeat. Is there a risk she might have to if she doesn't get the growth she hopes for?
That risk is definitely there. They're clearly trying to send this message. It's kind of one and done, that this was special surgery required because of the, as you heard, the shocking cover-up of the previous budget, as they are putting it. And they're sending the message that their plans for the future don't require further tax rises if things go to plan. Now, of course, the lesson of the past 5 years, I don't even tell you, pandemic, energy crisis, all that sort of stuff, straight out of the window, and taxes would go up, right? I think, and they would acknowledge that privately. But as current plans go, we do indeed have a bit of a boost to public spending over the next couple of years. Then there's a tight spending review that will be negotiated over the next 6 months and decided in April for the 3 years after that. Events, and including, just what's happening over the pond in America in terms of what that's doing to markets and the instability of an American election. So, yeah. Mm.
You mentioned markets. What sort of wider reaction have you seen? I think the IMF have made some remarks as well.
Yeah, well, let's take the markets first. It was really quite interesting. I mean, 25 years I've been watching budgets, and almost no reaction ever from the markets until the mini budget, when it was extraordinary. And we were watching, and it was actually a story. It changed during the hour. It was very benign. Actually, the bond yield, the effective interest rate, went down as she was speaking. That's exactly what you'd want if you're a new chancellor, commanding the moment, not spooking anybody. When the figures got published, up spiked the interest rate paid effectively in the markets for debt. And everyone's like, oh, what's going on here? And then it just calmed down and it was left barely above where we were. So benign. And they will take that, because these are really significant, massive changes for spending, for taxation and for borrowing. And they've changed the fiscal rules. They will feel that this has landed well. And on top of that, they get this Brucey bonus of the IMF turning up in rare kind of intervention on a budget day, saying that they back these moves, they're going to boost because they boost growth, and they back the sustainable raising of revenue. So they back the tax rises too.
How far into different territory does this take us in terms of us becoming more of a high tax, high spend, more sort of like our European neighbours style economy?
We're on the path to that. We're on the path to that in terms of spending as a proportion of GDP and taxation. Not quite there, certainly not at French levels, but yeah, it's some continental European. Certainly we're moving, on a spectrum, moving away from the North American low tax model. And this has happened, and you can tell a really interesting story here, that the pandemic, since the pandemic, the need for a bigger state and the public acceptance of that, maybe subconsciously, has been there. As soon as we had the energy crisis, people reached for the big state lever. And in a way, these tax rises are catching up with that. The Conservatives wanted to reverse that. Labour have sort of acquiescing in it, although they don't really want to acknowledge that as the strategy. But I think you have to watch the investment increases going forward. That is a significant change. And if you look at it, the 28 billion, the famous 28 billion that they cancelled ahead of the election because they were too shy about it, as far as I can see, it's back.
Faisal, thank you very much indeed. We turn to America now. Donald Trump and Kamala Harris are both holding campaign events in the Midwestern state of Wisconsin this evening, with less than a week to go until that US election. Wisconsin is among a handful of swing states where the outcome remains uncertain that will decide the result. Polls are suggesting there is nothing to choose between the two parties, both in the presidential contest and in separate congressional races. Democrats used to count on Wisconsin. It was a brick in the party's so-called blue wall until Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton by 0.7% in 2016. 4 years later, Joe Biden won by the same narrow margin. So which way will the pendulum swing this year? Well, The World Tonight's Jamie Kumarasamy spent time in rural southwestern Wisconsin after that 2016 election. He's been back this week to assess the political mood.
Look at this! Yeah, they probably think I should be dumping them some buckets of corn pretty soon.
In the rolling hills of southwestern Wisconsin, farmer Rob Kinch surveys his 50 purebred Angus cows and sings the praises of his two guard donkeys.
They're supposed to be good to keep the coyotes away. I've seen videos of a donkey just tear the hell out of a mountain lion. It's quite an interesting video.
We didn't get to see the video, but we did hear Trump supporting Rob's assessment of the economic challenges facing America's beef, corn and dairy farmers, as well as his radical remedy.
Inflation hurts you on all the commodities. You can't afford to have somebody fix anything for you. They want $100, $150 an hour. So I think we're so far in debt from the federal government and printed so much money in the last 4 years from COVID.
So is there anything a new government could do?
My personal plan, if I was president of the United States right now, I would fire 50% of the federal employees. We don't need them all fussing over every little thing we do. That would cut the budget immensely. And when they figured out how to get by with half the employees they got now, I'd fire another half.
We've just left Rob's farm and we're heading to Platteville. It's the largest town in Grant County. It's got just over 11,000 inhabitants and is best known for its university, UW-Platteville. In the past, though, it was most famous for its lead and zinc mines. They are now all closed, but immortalised in a giant letter M on a hillside that overlooks the town, said to be the largest letter M in the world. I'm going to catch up with someone I last met when I was in Platteville 6 years ago.
The city of Platteville is very Democratic, but the surrounding area is very Republican. This area is kind of a blueberry in a bowl of red jello.
The man with the food-based description of the county's political dynamics is Steve Prestigard, editor of the local newspaper, the Platteville Journal. Republican Red has certainly been on a roll in this part of southwest Wisconsin. Donald Trump increased his share of the vote in Grant County in 2020, even as Joe Biden narrowly won the state. I asked Steve whether anything had changed politically in the past few years.
Well, there's a lot that hasn't changed, but I think it's gotten more intense. Politics drives people crazy. Some of the people that I know basically are incapable of having a political conversation. And you'd kind of wonder how this is all going to work out after November 5th.
Wandering around, a lot that's familiar, but one thing I noticed immediately is different, is the Democratic and the Republican Party have their headquarters almost opposite each other now. That wasn't here before. How is that going?
Well, I think they haven't had any issue. There's kind of a demilitarized zone of the pizza place and the hotel and library between the two of them.
Well, this is what Steve calls Platteville's demilitarized zone. Just in front of me is the Republican Party of Grant County's office. The sign says, for a strong economy, vote Trump. And just down the road, past Steve's Pizza Palace, which since I was last here has added a new dairy delight to the menu, a mac and cheese pizza, there is a big Harris and Waltz sign and the Democratic Party of Grant County's headquarters.
Welcome.
Thank you. Hi, Jamie Kumarasamy from the BBC. Nice to meet you, Jamie.
Nice to... I'm Joyce Boss. I'm the chair of the Grant County Democrats, and I'm really happy to have you come this morning. I don't think it's our job to persuade the people. I think it's our job to get out as many people to vote as possible. And we believe that the people that think the Democratic way far outnumber the people that think the Republican way. So if we can make them feel assured that their vote counts in getting them out to vote, I think we're going to see a landslide. Here in Wisconsin, we call a landslide 1%.
What a nice warm applause coming out on a Monday night. Folks, we've got 8 days to go.
The presidential race isn't this year's only close contest in Wisconsin. In a Platteville bar, the Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate, businessman Eric Hovda, addresses a Trump-loving crowd. His message takes in familiar themes of open borders and trans ideology, but the messenger is slick and the language respectful, and he gets the loudest applause when he talks about unity.
You know,
living in our echo chambers. We're putting on the red jersey or blue jersey, fighting amongst ourselves. We got to put on the red, white, and blue jersey and come together, get things done and fixed.
After the event, he told me how he planned to achieve that.
First of all, you start lowering the rhetoric, and then you start reaching across the aisle. When I get to Washington, D.C., I'm going to go meet every Democratic senator. In the world of business, if you're not willing to compromise, you're never going to get anything done. But in the world of politics, our current politics, there's no compromise, and they're throwing bombs at each other. And I think we got to move past that.
To talk more about my platform. I grew up on a dairy farm up in Eau Claire.
On the same evening, across town at the university, a Democratic candidate for Congress is emphasizing her farming roots as she tries to woo first-time voters. I spoke to two of them, a young female student firmly in the Harris camp and her less convinced male friend.
Hi, my name is Allie. I'm a sophomore here at UW-Platteville.
And my name is Jackson, and I am also a sophomore studying chemistry.
I'm really passionate about politics, and I would say that definitely access to reproductive health care is a big concern for me. I will share, I am a victim of sexual assault, and, luckily nothing ever came of it, but heaven forbid I was pregnant as a result of it, I would absolutely want access to health care, yeah.
So I guess I can guess which way you'll be voting, can I?
You sure can.
Right, well, let's bring in the man.
Yeah, come on,
Jeff. Is women's rights, is that important to you?
Women's rights is very important to me. The reason I'm here is just to become more informed. So,
and have you made up your mind? How are you going to vote?
I have not made up my mind.
You are this absolute key demographic, the undecided voter in a swing state where the margins are tiny. What are you waiting to hear?
Some of the topics I do care very much for is like border security, our economy.
So Jackson's undecided. Are you trying to convince him?
I don't think there's a lot of convincing to be done. I think it's a lot of reconsidering the relationships you have with women in your life. And we are some of the closest women to Jackson. I think it's just showing up for the women in your life.
Jackson, you've got your arms folded, which, body language experts might say is... Not a great look at this point. There we go. In your pockets now. Go on. Yep. So how do you react to that?
That will be a consideration, but I also don't want it to affect me greatly. About just because everybody I know is going one way doesn't mean I'm going to follow. I'd like to think for myself and reach my own decision without a lot of influence from others.
Jackson, a student at UW-Platteville in southwest Wisconsin. Ending that report by Jamie Kumarasamy. Some of the other main headlines tonight. Rescue teams in southern Spain continue to hunt for those missing after flash flooding killed at least 95 people. One of the victims was a 71-year-old British man who died after being rescued in Malaga. The town of Orno de Alcedo, just outside Valencia, experienced some of the worst of the floods. The mayor, Consuelo Tarazón, spoke to the BBC World Service.
By 8 p.m. in the night, water started coming in great amounts and the town was flooded in minutes. The currents were so quick and we called the emergency services who started rescuing some people who had water up their necks. But we've had a very terrible night. In my 58 years, I've never seen anything like this before.
Consuelo Tarazón, mayor of Orno de Alcedo in Spain. In other news, a case of Mpox, formerly known as monkeypox, linked to the recent outbreak in parts of Africa, has been detected in the UK. Mpox was declared a global health emergency by the World Health Organization in the summer. Its symptoms include lesions of the skin, fever, headaches, and low energy. The patient had recently returned from an affected country and is being treated at the Royal Free Hospital's Specialist High Consequence Infectious Diseases Unit in London. Now we return to today's budget to hear at greater length from the Conservative opposition and specifically a response to this charge levelled at them today by the Chancellor.
In July, I exposed a £22 billion black hole at the heart of the previous government's plans. A series of promises that they made but had no money to deliver. Covered up from the British people, covered up from this House.
Well, as you heard, that prompted jeers and head-waving from the Conservative front bench in particular, especially Rishi Sunak and the Shadow Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, who bore the brunt of the accusation that they withheld information on spending from the Office for Budget Responsibility. Well, earlier I spoke to the Shadow Financial Secretary to the Treasury, the Conservative MP, Nigel Huddleston. How did he respond to the Chancellor's claim that his party, back in the spring, didn't tell the OBR the full financial story?
Multiple commentators have said, look, the public finances are an open book. And what Rachel Reeves said in the chamber versus what the OBR have actually said are two different things. When you're in government, you're responsible for tax and spending. So if there is a black hole, it's because of Labour's, they're in power now, because of Labour's spending plans. And if there is a black hole, why on earth have they dug so much deeper? You know, since they came to power, they announced 10 billion of inflation busting pay increases, 8 billion for GB Energy, 7 billion for a national wealth fund, and billions more today. It doesn't stack up. It's a pure deflection exercise from Rachel Reeves to try and cover for basically lying to the public about their tax and spending plans.
But there is still that point about what the OBR said in March about the lack of information from the government of which you were a part then. Are you saying they're not telling the truth about that?
No, I'm saying that there's always some element of clarity every single time there is any tax and spending plans, because it's all about forecasts. And one of the things the OBR talks about in the statistics today is about underspends. You never know what the underspends are. We've gone through a whole series of tax and spending decisions based in the various budgets and the fiscal events that we had under Jeremy Hunt. Mm. And we sometimes make adjustments to them. This is the case. What the Labour Party is struggling with now is that they told the public that they would have everything fully funded. They said that they would broadly keep our tax policies, and then came in and had a massive spending splurge. So surprise, surprise, there's then a gap. And they're now trying to blame us for their gap.
Let me then explore what the Institute for Fiscal Studies today has said about Labour's fiscal inheritance, describing it as truly dire. It does bear repeating, they say, that the fiscal inheritance is truly dire. The spending plans inherited from the last government were never likely to survive contact with a spending review. Tax rises were always a near inevitability. Do you accept that?
Well, unfortunately, we did have to increase taxes, and they were forecast to increase slightly over the coming years. And that, again, was very transparent, and the reason being the obvious result of spending £400 billion on the pandemic, which, by the way, the Labour Party didn't object to at the time, but seem to have now forgotten about. So, look, there were significant increases in spending and significant increases in debt out of necessity. What the Labour Party are doing now is increasing spending and increasing taxes out of choice.
Do you welcome today's extra spending on health?
Well, we had plans for additional spending on.
£22 billion?
We had plans for additional spending all over the place. I don't really care how much the spending is. The key thing is what the health outcomes are. And again, one of the real dangers with Labour is that they think the solution to everything is just throwing money at it. Again, go back to the doctors' dispute. Not a single condition of productivity improvements on that.
But you'll be aware of what Lord Darzi's report said about spending specifically on the health service during the period of your government, highlighting a £37 billion capital spending shortfall over the past decade and a half, he said, with all the negative consequences of that. Do you recognise that? Do you acknowledge that that was a significant shortfall and did significant harm to the NHS?
I don't believe there was harm to the NHS. We put huge amounts of money in the NHS. There's hundreds of thousands of more people working for the NHS under the last government. And many people get very good outcomes of the NHS. And I can't stand this constantly talking down of the NHS. It does huge amounts of good service for this country and people work really hard in it. The reality is it will always be squeezed and the budget will always be challenging. But again, we had significant real-term increases in spending when we were in power. This government has announced further increases. Fine, but I want to see productivity improvements and outcomes from that.
Conservative Nigel Huddleston, Shadow Financial Secretary to the Treasury. It's 50 years since the boxing bout hailed as the greatest fight of all time. The Rumble in the Jungle in 1974 pitted the already legendary Muhammad Ali against George Foreman in the heat of Zaire, now the Democratic Republic of Congo. Seasoned boxing pundits at the time said it was a fight Ali couldn't win. He'd lost some of his prime boxing years to a ban for refusing to fight in Vietnam, and he was said to be no match for Foreman's unrelenting power. But after an epic struggle over 8 rounds, he defied those pundits and won with a knockout blow. My colleague Andrew Peach on the BBC World Service has been reminiscing about the fight with none other than George Foreman.
I had always been real nervous, butterflies before boxing matches. But for the first time in my boxing career, I was in Africa, didn't have any butterflies, was not afraid, and it was probably the most comfortable I'd felt before a boxing match that night.
So when you heard Muhammad Ali talking the talk and saying he was going to beat you, you thought he'd got no chance?
He didn't say a word to me until seconds before the boxing match when we came to the center to be introduced by the referee. He looked at me and looked like he was trying to psych me out because I stared at him with a fierceness. He said, George, you don't have business in here with me. You were in high school when I won the championship of the world. And I almost burst out laughing because I never saw a day in high school in my life. Somebody told him wrong.
And what was he saying to you during the fight? Because those of us who've seen it can see that he's talking to you. What was he saying, if you remember?
I remember one frightening moment, could have been about the sixth or seventh round. I hit him so hard, and he said, "That all you got, George?" I wanted to tell him, "Yep, that's all I got." And of course, I kept hitting him, but I'd run out of gas.
Tell me about the rope-a-dope thing, because no one had done that before. Could you work out what this strategy was that he was basically making up during the match?
Well, my thing was to corner a guy, cut the ring off, and then batter him up. And a couple of times he tried to move, and it wasn't there for him. I cornered him and just started hammering him. And it must have been about the third round. I wailed on him, and the bell rang, and he looked at me and looked as if to say, I made it. And I looked at him and said, he made it. That was a surprise and turning point in that fight. I don't know how he made it.
Tell me about the end of the fight.
Well, swiftly, I kept following him around, trying to knock him out. He slipped, and when I missed him, he slipped and hit me with a 1-2, the most fast right hand I'd ever not seen, if you know what I mean. And there I was, tumbling down like a tree. And waiting for the ref to count, I jumped up, the fight was over.
Great to hear George Foreman's reflections. Just time for our closing headlines. The first Labour budget in 14 years has set out tax rises of £40 billion. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, confirmed increases to employers' national insurance and capital gains tax, but she surprised many by refusing to extend the freeze on income tax thresholds and keeping the cap on fuel duty. There were also more borrowing and spending commitments. The Conservative leader, Rishi Sunak, accused her of breaking promise after promise. And that's The World Tonight. This is Julian Warwicker for now from me and everyone on the programme. Have a very good night.